God is with you.
Also with you.
Let us pray. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. So the thing about doing the wrong thing is that it usually ends up being more than one thing. There's the initial thing, the mistake or the misdeed that sets off the whole chain reaction. But then there's all the other things you do to cover up the first thing, all the lies you tell, all the attempts to save face or shift the blame. And in the end, you're more guilty than you ever would have been if you just came clean way back when you first screwed up. It's like you robbed a bank, and instead of fessing up and returning the money, you go kill the guy that saw you do it. I'm in a bad situation. Quick, let's make it worse. In the story we read together today, David is finding himself in just that same sort of downward spiral. He starts off making one mistake, perhaps one of the oldest mistakes a person can make, a mistake that many kings had made before him and would make after him, but David was the chosen one. He was the best king around. He couldn't leave such a mark on his record. No, he had to cover it up. He had to make it go away. I'm getting ahead of myself. So first, what exactly did David do? In the very first sentence, we hear that the story is set in the springtime when, as the passage says, the kings go off to war. So that's a little jarring to read. The ground is thawing, the flowers are blooming, the birds are singing. Time to go kill a bunch of enemy soldiers. That's what we do every year. Some people have a picnic. Me, I like to do some live target archery. So yeah, it seems like a strange and maybe an unnecessary detail, but it's important. This is the time of year when kings go off to war. So what's David doing? Why is he laying around on his couch in the palace, staring out the window at the girl next door? Wasn't David always fighting right along his people? Wasn't that what he was known for? He was known for risking his life just like they risked theirs. Well, it seems that things have changed. David is no longer the king that leads by example. He's no longer the king that sacrifices for his people. He's got a guy for that. After all, he is way too important to get his royal robes dirty. So while his countrymen and the kings of other nations are at war, David is relaxing and eating bonbons and staring out the window, or I guess off the edge of the roof. And what should he see than a woman minding her own business? Just trying to do what the scriptures told her she had to do. I know having a rooftop bathtub seems weird and a bit exhibitionist to us now, but at the time it really wasn't. Most buildings were about the same height. The roofs were flat, they had a wall around the edge, so you couldn't see anything if you were just another regular folk. They stored food up there, people slept up there. They did all kinds of things on the roof because it was cooler and nicer than being inside of a house. At those days before air conditioning and all of that stuff. The passage tells us that Bathsheba wasn't just taking a nice bubble bath for the luxury of it either. She was specifically doing a ritual cleansing, one that every woman had to do when her period was over. So she's on her roof in a bathtub specifically built for ritual cleansing. So she couldn't have done this anywhere else except on her roof. Observing God's law. She's not trying to catch David's eye. David shouldn't even be home. But David does catch a peek. And like, let's all be real for a second. There's nothing wrong with David seeing her and thinking, oh, she's hot. That's fine. I don't think he set out to spy on her. I really don't. But there is a world of difference between him enjoying the view and then going on about his business. And what he actually does. We all hoped it wouldn't happen. We all hoped he'd be different, but it seems that being king has thoroughly gone to David's head. Because David doesn't think, man, I probably shouldn't be looking at her. Okay, I'm gonna go inside and give her some So Bathsheba is brought to David. I'm certain without being asked whether she was interested or not. And even if she were asked, what exactly would you, a woman with no rights whatsoever, say to the king during the time when a king's favorite springtime activity was killing the neighbors? So David gets what he wants, and he sends Bathsheba away, and he would never even have felt bad about it if she didn't come back a few weeks later to tell him, David, I'm pregnant. And even then, that's only a problem because her husband can't be the daddy because he's off at war like David should be. So David concocts this plan. He calls her husband Uriah home from battle, and he gives him shore leave, and Uriah is brought to the palace, and David says, hey, buddy, you're doing a great job with all this war stuff. How about you go home and wash your feet? Which I know this doesn't sound true, and I know it's gross, but wash your feet was a euphemism at that time for sleeping with somebody, and trust me, knowing that will ruin parts of the Old Testament for you. So anyway, David is telling Uriah, go home, sleep with your wife, because he needs it to be plausible that Uriah is the one that got Bathsheba pregnant. But the next morning, what should David see but Uriah sleeping on the steps of the palace? Oh, Uriah, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be home in bed with your wife? But Uriah won't go home. Not while his fellow soldiers are still away at war. So David tries again the next night. This time he gets Uriah absolutely spliffified, wasted, hammered, drunk, sure that this time he will go home to his wife if he's too inebriated to control himself. But even blitzed out of his mind, Uriah still doesn't leave, because as this passage reminds us over and over again, Uriah is a better person than David in every way. Every temptation that David falls prey to, Uriah is too honorable to give in to. So seeing that this clearly isn't going to work, David comes up with plan B. He sends Uriah to the front lines, and he instructs his chief officer to have all the other men fall back, leaving Uriah alone and defenseless. The plan works. Uriah doesn't survive the battle, so he's out of the way. And David, as soon as possible, marries Bathsheba to give the appearance that everything that happened was above board. We need to understand that David was the king. He could have admitted what happened. He could have financially provided for the kid. He could have taken Bathsheba in should Uriah have chosen to divorce her. It's not like there would have been any consequences for David. There weren't really any social or political consequences when word of what he did actually get out. He had so many options, but he went with murder. Murder of a man who had every quality David should have had, but didn't. Oh, how far our hero has fallen. Now, this isn't the end of David's story. There are moments of redemption to come, but he will never again quite be the man he was before he was king. The people have been given what they wanted. David is the best possible king, and still, this is what he does. It's almost like the point all along was that people aren't meant to rule like this or be ruled like this, that that's a job God and God alone can handle. Way back when we started this journey together, God told Samuel to tell the people that having a king would inevitably lead to trouble every single time. David was the chosen one. And if he can't stay uncorrupted by that kind of power, then nobody can. That's the point. David is referenced so often in the New Testament to point to Jesus, not because David was such a great king, but because David had everything going for him and he still failed. David is all the proof necessary to show us we need Jesus. We need a king fundamentally better than we are, one like us, and yet if we